for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Anita Desai's writing is often about art and language that exists on the margins. In a new collection of three novellas, the award-winning author explores the pain of being alone and the desire to disappear after failure. Her new book is titled The Artist of Disappearance, and Anita Desai joins me in the studio throughout the hour. You can join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you and welcome.
Good morning.
What a beautiful cover of the book, this shimmering leaf that looks as though it could disintegrate.
Exactly.
At any moment.
Exactly.
Tell
I think
me
it was well
that.
Chosen. I didn't choose it. It
you
was
didn't
the designer
choose it.
Did it.
What does it symbolize so accurately for you?
Well, for one thing, the colors strike me as being so very Indian. The red and the gold is certainly a very Indian combination. But I also look at that leaf as on the point of disappearance, as although it's so vivid, so bright, it's about to disappear too.
There's a fragility to that leaf, and yet we know that trees represent strength, that there is a changing of the times and a changing of the season when the leaves appear and then disappear. And you're talking a great deal in this book of three novellas about disappearance. Why did that concept come to you in this book?
To tell the truth, while I was writing it, I wasn't considering a theme that would link the novellas. But I did write them one after the other, so it must have been a theme present in my mind, a subconscious theme. And the ideas, the stories, seem to have grown out of that.
Tell me about your daughter, Karen. She describes your work as centered on vanishing, forgotten worlds. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, I suppose she's right. And that's because that vanishing world is one that I know. It's the one I grew up in. And you see less of, and less of it now in India. It is in the course of disappearing too. So perhaps, in a way, these stories are an effort to capture them before they completely vanish from sight.
What is it that's disappearing in India?
It's a country that's been overtaken by such rapid change. And throughout my childhood, I had a sense that nothing ever changes. Nothing ever will change. It'll always be the same as it is. So I look back now and think how wrong I was, how very much has changed.
Is that, do you think, sort of the usual pattern of childhood thought, thinking that everything is going to stay the same as it is today, and being both surprised and yet disappointed when it changes?
Well, when it changes, yes, it is a gradual surprise that overtakes you. And it's a very, very mixed emotion that one has about it. Part of it, almost relief, happy to see certain things vanish, and then a fear of it or vanishing altogether or in a way that you hadn't imagined.
Give me a sense of the India in which you grew up.
Well, I grew up in, certainly it was the post-colonial world, but it was newly post-colonial. I was a child in the era of Nehru and Gandhi, and therefore there was a great euphoria about Indian independence, at the freedom struggle having won this great prize of independence. There was a great deal of idealism at that point, and it was also very rapidly dashed, ruined by the partition of India and Pakistan and all the violence and the loss and the grief that that entailed. So it was always a very mixed blessing, that freedom, independence were quickly mixed with disorder and chaos. And therefore, this new life began under a certain shadow. And of course, over the years, the idealism has gradually faded and turned into cynicism. And the old world of tradition has given way to a new world of materialism, materialistic wants and needs, and a great sense of hurry, of speed. And I think the biggest difference in my early world and the present one is that I always had a sense that the one thing we are very rich in India is time. I couldn't understand why people in the West always complain of not having enough time. I always thought we have all the time there is. And I think that's probably disappearing from India too. Everyone is in a hurry. There's never enough time.
You actually grew up in a very interesting household with a mixed culture in your background. Talk about your mother and father.
Well, I grew up in North India, in Old Delhi, but that was home neither to my father nor to my mother. My mother came from Germany. She came just before, a good time before the war began, really. I should think in 1926 or 27 to India after marrying my father.
Did she meet your father?
He was Bengali from East Bengal. He'd gone to Germany as a student. And he met her while he was a student, married her there, brought her to India. But his country was also soon lost. My mother's to Nazism and to World War II, and my father's to partition, because what had been East Bengal to him became East Pakistan after partition, and then became Bangladesh. So both my parents found that their homes had vanished. They were lands they couldn't go back to. And they made a home in Delhi, which actually was a strange place to both of them. And I suppose I grew up with this sense of vanished lands, vanished paths, which existed for us only in what they told us, which were almost like fairy tales to us.
Did your mother leave her family behind?
Yes, she did.
In Germany?
She did. And during the war, there was no contact with them at all. No letters, no news at all. I remember one of the things I used to do as a child was accompany her to the post office with boxes of tea, coffee, sugar, cocoa, send them off. But we never knew if those boxes ever arrived at their destination. We just sent them. And her mother and her sister died during the war. And after the war, she really had no family left in Germany at all.
That must have been a very lonely existence for her, even with your father and with her children.
It must have been a very, very difficult time for her. I have no idea how she managed to survive it. I suppose she did it by accepting India as the one country that she had and her husband and children, the one family that she still had.
Did she ever talk to you about that loneliness, the disappearance of her family, the long-distance yearning that she must have had?
Not directly. It was something we sensed, because she would tell us in such detail about her childhood and the happy times in pre-war Germany. And she could, in her old age, still remember the walk from her house to her school and name every shop she passed on the way, the baker, the butcher, the bookshop. Every single thing was still vivid to her. And the stories she told us were always about Christmas in Germany, or Easter, or summer holidays. And it was just the nostalgia behind those stories that gave us a sense of how much she had given up.
Did you feel that she and your father, despite their extraordinarily different backgrounds, had a good and strong relationship?
On the whole, I suppose, yes. Both were so completely devoted to us, their children, and to making a life for us. They shared a lot. And since both had lost families, land, those simply didn't exist anymore, this was all they had, just each other.
Anita Desai, the artist of disappearance. Short break. Right back. And welcome back, my guest in this hour, Anita Desai. She's an award-winning writer whose career spans more than five decades. Her newest book is made up of three novellas. It's titled The Artist of Disappearance. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. I've always felt that novellas are very much like poetry. Even as you are writing a narrative, each and every word is so precious because the novella is short. Are you feeling the poetic mind as you're writing, or are you censoring yourself as you are writing a novella as opposed to writing a novel?
Well, if I had thought of them as novels, of course, I would have taken the stories into many different directions. I would have been allowed digressions, diversions of all kinds. And I realized that in a novella, I can't do that. It has to be much more focused, a very focused story. And yet it's not a compressed novel. It's not a little moment in time like a short story. It's more like a single significant episode in a life. Allowing all that is around it, childhood, old age, other adventures, to recede into the background and to focus, to highlight just that one significant episode.
Tell us about the first story, The Museum, A Final Journey.
Well, there the narrator, the civil servant, of course, has a long career. He could have described his entire career, his childhood, his education, his marriage. He doesn't do it. He just describes this one short episode in his life when he was a junior officer, and something unexpected happens when he finds himself going around this strange collection of objects in the middle of wasteland, really, in a ruined, crumbling mansion.
Why is he called there?
The owners are no longer around. It's in the hands of a caretaker. The caretaker feels this collection is in danger of being lost, and he values it greatly because it's given him the meaning of his life. He's taking care of what he thinks is a fabulous collection. He hopes that the government might take over, and so he comes to the civil servant and asks for some assistance.
And the civil servant at first thinks he might be of great help, and it might indeed enhance his own being to be part of that collection.
Yes, he's been told the story of the history of this collection by the caretaker, and it's somewhat mysterious, and he's somewhat intrigued. At least in a very boring life in this backwards, he feels this might be a little interesting interlude, so he goes to look at it.
And what happens?
He very soon tires of it. He realizes this isn't great art. It's simply a jumble of objects put together by the young master of that mansion, who had traveled a great deal and sent back this collection in boxes to his mother, who still lived there. And although it obviously meant a lot to him, to the traveler, and perhaps to the mother who received it, it really had no value beyond that.
Would you read for us, starting on page 27, the paragraph beginning, "Unfortunately"?
Unfortunately, the next chamber was one of stuffed birds, and they did little to improve my spirits. If anything, the glass eyes set in grey sockets were even more accusing, and I was certain that their faded, iridescent feathers were creeping with parasitic life. The only living creatures visible in these chambers were the spiders that spun their webs to make shrouds for the birds, and the geckos that probably fed on the spiders. I saw one lizard flattened against the wall, immobile, a pulse beating under its nearly transparent skin to show it was just waiting for us to leave, for night to fall, so it could come to life again. In one doorway, a gecko caught by the slam of the door had left its fragile skeleton splayed against the plaster like a web spun by one of the spiders to stay till it peeled. "Is this," I demanded, "is this the young master's collection?" If there was sarcasm in my tone, it was intentional. My guide, proving aware of it, quickly responded, No, this was left to him by his ancestors. Now we will go to see his collection." And to my huge relief, we came out into a corridor completely bare of trophies, one side opening onto a courtyard where a marble goddess stood in a shallow basin of a waterless fountain. Her limbs were broken at the joints, and Licken had crept up her sandaled feet to the hem of her robe. This stretch of corridor evidently led to the wing that held the items sent to the estate by the absconding master in containers that had created such a stir in the district and a legacy for the inheritors, if any. And now my guide produced the ring of keys from behind his back, because we had come to a door that was locked. Choosing one extraordinarily long key from the ring, he inserted it into the lock and turned it with a great sense of drama. I followed him in with some trepidation and impatience. How many more hunting trophies and murdered spoils was I to be shown? The heat of the day was gathering in these closed, unventilated rooms, and although it must have been noon by now, there was very little light here. Except I was astonished to find what the collection itself radiated. The chamber we had entered was hung, draped, laid and overlaid with rugs in the splendid colours of royalty, plum, wine, mulberry and pomegranate, woven into intricate patterns. I hesitated to step on one. They were surely precious, besides had not been touched in ages, by hand, still less by foot. Only a Raja might recline on one with his Rani while listening to the music of sitar and sarod, tabla and tanpura. I could imagine these invisible potentates and pashas lifting goblets in their ringed hands, or better still, the chaste silver mouthpiece of a hookah. Lives lived in such a setting could only have been noble and luxurious, not of this poor, hard-worked land all around. It was only when I lowered my eyes to examine them more closely that I noted what the imperial colours concealed. Patches that were faded, threadbare, some even darned and mended clumsily.
Anita Desai, from her collection of three novellas, it's titled The Artist of Disappearance. She read from the first, titled The Museum of Final Journey. And so we hear of the anticipation of this civil servant. We hear of his sort of looking forward to seeing gorgeous riches and luxuries, and he finds a threadbare rug.
He eventually finds it very depressing, oppressive. He wants to get away from it. These are all, to him, dead objects, fading, without much value, and he's impatient and wants to leave. And then he's shown one final gift, and that's the only living one that is still to be found there in this mansion. And it is an old, aged, sad elephant standing in the bamboo grove outside. And it hasn't died. It's still feeding and feeding. It refuses to die. And I've been asked, well, what does an elephant stand for? It is, of course, symbolic. Elephants are symbols, aren't they, of longevity and also of memory. And it seemed to me that all these objects in the museum, they had died once they'd been removed from their context, the lands and histories to which they belonged, and come to this place which had no understanding of them and had been abandoned too. But the elephant is the only thing one still has that still lives, and that's memory. And that links up with the epigraph I've used for the book. It's a quotation from Borges. One thing alone does not exist, oblivion.
Anita Desai. We're talking about her new book titled The Artist of Disappearance, Three Novellas. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. I look forward to hearing from you. Do you feel a kinship with some of those isolated characters?
I suppose I do. I've so often written of them. But it's interesting to me as a writer because I have a feeling that when a person withdraws into extreme solitude, they discover things about themselves which they may not be willing to display to the outer world that only they know about. So it's a way of reaching deep into the souls of my characters. Of course, I could go the other way and show them interacting with a society around them, but that would reveal many different aspects of their character. The one that interests me is, what are they in the dead of the night when they're absolutely alone?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Peoria, Illinois. Good morning, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Morning, sir.
Well, first of all, I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing her on the air. And immediately, your description of the leaf about to disintegrate, it just kind of jumped out. With people going through challenges today, and I think about the author's mother and the strength and courage it took her to persevere, continuing to send the gifts by faith, not knowing if they arrived to her mother and sister. To me, that's just a sign of courage and continue to persevere in spite of the odds. And I guess my question, well, it's not a question, I guess you can say so. It's thinking about the elephant as a symbol of strength, knowing that when people go through the challenges we're faced with today, the elephant is a sign of strength, being able to anchor and remember the things that matter the most if we don't have the things we think we're supposed to have, but thinking about things that matter the most and being strong and standing in there. What can you say as far as your book, how it relates, you know, in encouraging people today and all the challenges we're faced with concerning the economy and job loss?
What a wonderful question, Anita.
It's too large for me. It's too enormous. I would not know how to relate it to the kind of problems and worries that one has in going about the world today. I don't know if I meant it to encourage or give anyone strength to go on. But I suppose a story which deals largely with symbols can be applied to so many situations today, situations which are totally unlike those that I describe in the story. Being symbols, one can pick and choose and apply them to one's own life.
And isn't that the beauty of literature?
I suppose that is why we read it and love it.
That is why we read, to, I think, help us to understand, imagine, create not only other worlds, but to somehow take from that to apply to our own world. I thought his was a lovely question. And one thing I wanted to ask you, I was so interested to learn that Laura Ingalls Wilder was such a huge influence on your own career in writing.
I think that's what my daughter gave away once when I was telling her how I used to have pen friends all over the world and write to them when I was a child. And I had one here in the States, who sent me Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, I think it was, on the banks of Plum Creek. And my daughter still has that book. She loves it. And I used to read it to my children when they were small. And yes, it was a world and a life totally different from ours. But that didn't matter at all. Once one had read it, once one loved it, it became one's own.
It expanded.
Yes, exactly.
Your own world. You could see different ways of thinking, living. I mean, that's what books have always done for me. Anita Desai. We'll take a short break here. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by ESET, offering home internet security with parental controls to fight spam, viruses, and cybercrime. ESET.com. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting research on how social factors like housing and jobs affect health. Learn more at rwjf.org. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
This is the song, la 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 la, Elmo's song.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Muppeteer Kevin Clash, who performs Sesame Street's Elmo and is the subject of the new documentary, Being Elmo. He'll bring Elmo to the interview. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Catchy. He loves to sing, la 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 la, Elmo's song.
Oh, sing it.
La 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 la, la 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 la.
And welcome back. We're going to take some more of your calls, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts. Good morning, Harriet. You're on the air.
Good morning. Anita, thank you very much for writing and speaking. I have a different sort of disappearing story. I first went to India to study Hindustani vocal music in 1971, and I've lived some 5 or 6 years in Varanasi and other parts of India. And I have an adopted daughter from India who's 21 now, and I speak Hindi, and I'm blind. So I was thinking about how the visual changes and disappears over periods. But what I was recalling is that my Varanasi ride on the bicycle rickshaw from the train station to the university, to the BHU, has utterly changed. When I went there first, the only sound or the major sound you heard were the sound of rickshaw bells all those miles between the train station and there. And as you well know, and I've been back many times, the congestion and the noise level, just the noise levels in India have gone up, maybe eightfold. And although I was sequestered at times in the university campus, which was still full of birds and very peaceful. So The other thing I wanted to say is here I am, simply a Caucasian woman who, by the way, lived 2 years in Germany and I have strong German connections, too. And yet I have this part of me that no one here sees, which is a disappeared and yet completely present part of me, which is completely identified with India. So thank you for somehow bringing this forward, both in your own life and also in the way you write about it. Perhaps we all need a place to re-experience loss and, I don't know, find a new view, perhaps. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was fascinating, look into your world. Love to know more about it.
Would you agree that the sounds of India have increased, as Harriet suggested, at least eightfold?
Yes, certainly in the cities, and there are more and more of the cities now. You would have to go very far into the depths of rural India to regain some of that peace which was common to us earlier.
Here's an interesting email. And Harriet, that was such a beautiful statement. Thank you for calling us today. Here's an email from Allison, who says, "Your descriptions are beautiful. I used to write poetry myself to save a specific moment in time." She goes on to say, "I have a tendency to grieve many things, but once I've written down the situation as it was exactly, only then can I let go of grief." She wonders, is that true for you? And do you reread your books to relinquish grief if you are grieving something else again?
You know, I don't think I've ever written anything very personal. I've always invented characters and, for the most part, situations do. All I share with my characters is often the landscape, the situation. But I think one writes. If one is a writer, then one writes in order to create some kind of order out of the chaos of all the impressions, all the experiences one has. They're chaotic, they don't make sense. But when I'm sitting down and writing them down on paper and seeing them as sentences, they begin to make sense. I think it's a way of imposing order, of creating some kind of control over what otherwise is completely out of control.
Your second story, Translator Translated, is about a woman in the depths of solitude who feels very strongly that she wants to do something that will help her in her own understanding of herself. And she turns to the translation of a writer she so admires. Would you read for us from that?
Prema not only read the collection of Suvarna Devi's short stories, but returned to the bookshop to see if they had any more of her work. They did not, but in the college library, she came across a journal the writer had kept while living in the tribal areas to the south. It was bound in green rexine, and the library flap at the back showed that it had been issued to readers exactly twice in the last 7 years. Prema borrowed it and took it back to read in the hostel, and found the journal entries, many of them of an anthropological nature, and the notes on village life in the forest, provided a backdrop for the fiction she had already read, but were otherwise disappointingly dry. Prema had little interest in nature or the rituals and ceremonies of tribal society per se, and found the notes lacking in the characters and events that had made the short stories so lively and engaging. She asked her companions at the hostel if they knew anything of the life of this author, so oddly divided between literature and anthropology. "Oh, she goes to those areas with her husband," they told her. "He's a doctor and runs clinics there. Who wants to read about that?" It suddenly occurred to Prema that the writer might live in this very town. She was told casually that, yes, they believe she did. "Where?" cried Prema. "Can you tell me where?" Her mind leapt ahead to that prized objective of any serious student, a personal interview. Besides, such a meeting might create another link to her mother's world. And there was so little time left. She was due to return to Delhi in just a week. Someone told her in which part of the town Suvarna Devi's husband had his practice, but no one could give her a specific address. They knew Suvarna Devi's work from their school syllabus, but that did not make her a local celebrity. Instead, it just made her one of them. Prema went there on foot one day after her class to see if she could find it for herself. It was a neighborhood rather like a suburb on the far outskirts of Delhi, where the city petered out into the dusty plains. A jumble of small bungalows, no longer new, many with signboards on the gates to denote their middle-class status: doctors, lawyers, advocates, specialists in gynecology, homeopathy, Ayurveda, urology, and also schools that gave evening classes in typing, shorthand, and tailoring. Not knowing the exact address and coming across the same surnames repeated over and over, Prema gave up, suddenly conscious of the dust gathering between her toes and invading the folds of her neck and elbows, sticky and gritty at the same time. She could not continue to trail up and down the maze of little streets with dogs barking at her through closed gates, men staring at her from bicycle and radio repair shops and concrete bus shelters under stunted, lopped trees. Defeated, she returned to the hostel. It did not matter, she told herself, as she packed for the long journey back to the capital. She had found the subject of her studies, and that was all that mattered. How could she have returned without one?
Anita Desai, reading from the second of three novellas in her new book titled The Artist of Disappearance. And we're going to now go back to the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Jeffrey in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Yes. I was wondering whether that Mr. Stein knew, his mother knew her family had died, learned her, that her family had have died. Did she ever find out how, or did she ever tell Mr. Zai about it?
I do know that all the male members of her family died in the war, fighting in the war. Her mother and sister must have died of sickness, old age in her mother's part.
Thanks for your call, Jeffrey. And to Peoria, Illinois. Good morning, Bert.
Good morning. I came out of the health department today after getting my shots for my trip to India next month. I've been there twice before. I think that In Custody is by far my favorite book and just nails India. And as I hear you describe the second of your novellas about a student pursuing their favorite writer, it reminded me of In Custody. I love the movie In Custody. I wonder if Ms. Desai liked the movie, and I know it ended a little bit different.
It was an interesting experience, I have to say. The director of the movie, Ismail Merchant, is someone I had known for a long time, since I was a young girl. And he'd always asked me to write a script for him, which I had never done. But when he read In Custody, I think it related to so many of his own passions, his obsessions, the ones with Urdu poetry, with music. And he was determined to make a film of that. And he did it with such enthusiasm, such passion, really, which completely swept my own hesitations aside. I certainly didn't look upon the film as a reflection of the book. I realized he had taken the book and contributed so much to it of his own experience, his own loves, and made something else out of it, much more colorful, much more elegant than my book. And it couldn't have been otherwise if he hadn't brought his own his own love and excitement to it. He couldn't have made the film. And I think some of that idea works its way into this story of a translator who carries the act of translation a bit too far. But she couldn't have done it otherwise. She had to take it over and turn it into a creative act, not simply an act of translation.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. When you say she took it too far and made it into an active creativity, what do you mean? She overstepped her bounds. How?
She was so in love with the work of Suvarna Devi that she had so much to express herself about it that she couldn't just do a literal translation, which is done automatically without much involvement. She gets too deeply involved with the work, and it becomes a creative act for her. The creative act which had been suppressed for so long. She's a very suppressed character, and now she lets herself go and becomes free to take over this act of writing, and it's not a very faithful translation, and she is called up on that.
She is called up on that and retreats to her place of almost anonymity in her own teaching rather than the joyful experience she anticipated.
That's right. She just creeps away in hurt and in shame, I suppose, too, and back into hiding, really.
And finally, to Naples, Florida, and to Anita. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. I am so happy to hear such marvelous women. The world needs more of both of you. I had an experience wherein I went to Tibet this summer and visited sacred places. And in so doing, I believe I witnessed my own death. And in a return to the United States and my things and the people I love, I find myself completely changed. And I wonder if that is similar to the voodoo or voodam practice of experiencing your own death as part of a ritual. Do you have any ideas about that?
I don't. I don't have any experience of that or ritual. But I suppose you are talking about an experience many of us have of, I suppose we call it out-of-body experience, by which I suppose we mean when we lose our sense of self and stray.
And moving into a totally different kind of culture can bring on that kind of experience.
I suppose being taken out of, I would call, my own context, suddenly being free of it, would surely give you an experience of another possibility.
And that's precisely what Anita Desai's new trilogy of novellas does. Gives you another sense of possibility. The book is titled The Artist of Disappearance. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for asking me. I've enjoyed it.
I'm glad. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.